I'm Phil Latzman. Good afternoon. Welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN, our weekly mission to keep South Florida informed on local and regional news and issues affecting our community. From Tallahassee to Key West and beyond, with a panel of the area's top journalists. And this week, we welcome back to the program Tim Padgett, who covers South Florida, Latin America, and a whole lot more for Time Magazine, based here in South Florida. Good to see you, Tim.
Good to see you, too. Thanks.
Steve Rothaus covers all kinds of stuff, a former radio guy himself, who now writes the Gay South Florida column and issues related to it in the Miami Herald. Steve, we welcome you back to the program.
Phil, great to be back.
And Ashley Lopez is a reporter with WLRN.org and WLRN Miami Herald News. She's done a wonderful job with us for the last few months, covering elections and all the controversies that have gone on related to them and voting issues. In fact, she's moving on for a new position in Fort Myers. We wanted to get her on the program for her last day. Ashley, welcome back to you as well.
Thanks for having me.
And we are going to hear from you along the way as we take phone calls, and we are going to specifically discuss education with a member of our State Impact Florida team, Sarah Gonzalez. Some developments this week in Florida as a new education commissioner. We also asked you about the state of education in Florida through our Public Insight Network, and we'll hear some of those responses as well later on in the program. First, though, let's begin with Obamacare. And the House and Senate leaders in the state of Florida say they are not going to run a health care exchange because it cannot be decided before the legislature meets. Today is the deadline for whether or not the legislature will decide to create and run the state's own health care exchange, from which individual Floridians may purchase health insurance or let the federal government do it for them. And last week, state lawmakers heard from some passionate opponents of the law. This took place in the Capitol in Tallahassee. When lawmakers opened the floor to public comment, attorney Chris Ann Hall said, despite the Supreme Court ruling, the law is unconstitutional, and citizens will not accept it.
As you are considering what you're going to do, a primary consideration will be, how will we deal with the fallout of our citizens, both lawfully and constitutionally saying, we will not comply?
The Tallahassee audience then booed Fort Lauderdale State Senator Chris Smith, who, when he said that the Constitution had been corrected through its lifetime, pointing to slavery and the Jim Crow era.
Federal government had to step in because our Constitution is an imperfect document.
So there's some of the disconnect there. Ashley, you've been doing a great deal of coverage on this on our blog at WLRN.org. Governor Scott has promised to work with the federal government, but there still seems to be a lot of resistance from GOP leaders in the state about getting this done.
Yeah, well, this is mostly coming from, I mean, that audience, from what I understand, was a group of those Tea Party Republicans. And, you know, the Tea Party was created on the basis that they didn't like Obamacare. So, I mean, they're not going to let this go. They're going to say it's unconstitutional, even though the Supreme Court upheld it, because that is what they're there for. That is why they were even created to begin with. So, I mean, legislators are going to have to give this up because it's happening with or without them. But, you know, that people like this in the Tea Party, I mean, they don't have to really do anything. They can fight it all they want.
So if Florida's not going to have a decision on how it wants to proceed with the health care exchange, what happens now?
Well, the federal government, by law, is required to step in. You know, if the state decides they don't want to, you know, create that online marketplace for health insurance, you know, Kathleen Sebelius and her team has to come in and create one for them, because they have until, I think, 2014 to have it up and running.
Right. It officially goes into effect, all of it, in 2014. Governor Scott has said the reality has hit Tim Padgett. The elections happened. We've got to do something to sort of comply. But again, nothing has happened yet. And I guess whether or not it's important that the state comes in and runs it itself, or the federal government comes in. But it seems like there's a lot of people in Florida that don't want the federal government coming in and doing anything for them.
Well, the reason nothing has happened yet is because Rick Scott and the Republicans in Florida were so sure that Obama was going to lose the presidential election, and therefore they wouldn't have to worry about this, because as a result, Obamacare would be repealed. What they weren't counting on, and unfortunately, I think, was from their standpoint, is that everyone was saying this was going to add 1 million new Floridians to the Medicaid rolls, but those people won't vote. I'm beginning to wonder how many of these 1 million people who could potentially be added to the Medicaid rolls really did come out and vote. When you look at the great number, the much more than expected number of early voters, for example, that we saw, I think that constituency did come out and vote in a much larger extent than the Republicans had expected.
And Florida and other states, as Tim has mentioned, have to fully expand Medicaid eligibility if they want to tap into the billions of dollars in extra money under the Affordable Care Act. The announcement clearing up a lingering question for states deciding whether to dramatically increase the number of people enrolled in Medicaid. That's what they seem to say, is that this is going to cost us a lot of money and we can't do it.
But the fact, the other bottom line, though, is that Florida has one of the highest rates of uninsured people in its population. And that's politically, this just wasn't sustainable.
The governor sent President Obama a letter to meet with him about the impact of the new health care law. Steve, you think that health care, I think we were more accepting of it possibly in a more liberal place here in South Florida, but do you think there's a disconnect between what we feel here and perhaps other parts of the state?
Well, there may very well be a disconnect, but I think that also we have to start looking beyond this cycle that we've come through and now start to look towards 14, as you know, Scott is going to be running for re-election, and other Republicans who've been very much against this program until now, they're looking also at re-election. So perhaps there will be some kind of compromise.
And we want to remind you, by the way, that it's your show, too, and want to hear from you along the way. We're going to be taking calls on education topics in our next segment, and you can always email us at thefloridaroundup@gmail.com, and you can ring us up at 800-743-WLRN. One other reminder, we are tweetable. We're doing a lot of work on Twitter these days, I know, because I tweet a lot. I think all our panelists do. At WLRN is the handle for that, and our social media editor, Danny Rivero, is actually hosting an online discussion, so you can follow along there. Again, the tweet is at WLRN. Speaking of 2014, that got a lot more interesting this week. Panel, is Charlie Crist officially signed up as a Democrat? He made it official on Thursday. The former Republican governor and then independent candidate for Senate registered as a party member Thursday at the Pinellas County Supervisor of Elections office.
I'm very happy to be a Democrat, and it's very important that we all are comfortable where we are. And I can't tell you how comfortable I am as a Democrat. I feel like I've really come full cycle, and it's a blessing.
While many people in the Democratic Party have inquired about his future ambitions, Crist says he's not ready to announce his candidacy for anything just yet. He did, however, sound off a list of things he would do differently than his successor in Tallahassee, including Governor Scott's decision to turn down money for high-speed rail.
So I think that was disappointing. Defunding education, $1.3 billion the first year. As a public school kid, that really bothered me and disappointed me. You know, the way the environment's being treated, the disabled, you know, we could go on.
So, Ashley Lopez, you wrote about that this week on our blog at WLRN.org. He certainly sounds like a Democrat. Has he made the full transition?
I mean, I think so. It's been a slow move, but the real question is going to be if other Democrats sort of accept him. I mean, right outside of that Pinellas precinct, I mean, there were, you know, protesters with signs calling him a fake Democrat. I mean, that's going to be his biggest problem. Is he sellable to, you know, Democrats in Florida who were here while he was a Republican governor? That's going to be his real tough fight.
There were only three, apparently, Democrats that were outside of the Pinellas County Elections Office. Not exactly a flood of them, but
right.
Contrast that, though, with what he said. In 2009, this morning, I spent some time digging through the archives, and here's Charlie Crist when he was running for Senate.
Governor, on a scale, how would you rate your conservatism?
Well, as bad as conservative as you can get.
Are you ruling out that you will file as an independent by the April 30th deadline?
That's right. That's right. I'm running as a Republican.
My decision to run for the United States Senate as a candidate without party affiliation in many ways says more about our nation and our state than it does about me.
So, Tim Padgett, do you think Florida Democrats are going to embrace him? All they have to do is hit rewind.
I think they're going to have to embrace him, just speaking, you know, in terms of rail politics. Look, being a conservative Democrat was always Charlie Crist's destiny. I've referred to him sometimes in my pieces as Charlie Chrysalis. You know, that he's sort of a a caterpillar who has now evolved into the Democratic butterfly that I think he was always destined to become. And you could tell that, you know, when he was a Republican governor, he was always very much a moderate, always called himself an Abe Lincoln Republican. And I think he has, in the end, a better chance of probably defeating Rick Scott or any other Republican candidate in 2014. And I think he is interested because I talked to him a few weeks ago, and one of the things that stood out for me in our conversation was that he seemed to be recognizing or feeling anyway that that he feels that he was right about a lot of things when he was governor, particularly, for example, this was during the election in November, and he was pointing out, you know, that he was right about, extending early voting days and hours, for example. And I think he feels that a lot of the electorate in Florida feels that back in his day as governor, he had a lot of things right. And I think that's going to be a motivation for him to run.
He's certainly one of the more interesting political characters in Florida's history. And whatever he does, he's going to have everybody in the state watching for these next couple of years. It seems inevitable that he's going to run for governor again. He'll have to explain why he left office in the first place to run for Senate and change parties. So we'll have an interesting 2 years leading up to that. But Steve Rothaus, he said his biggest regret as a Republican was signing anti-gay marriage legislation, and he's totally made a 180 on that.
Well, I think it's also the biggest regret for many gay Democrats in the state, and they're not willing to forget. As of this moment, for the last week or so, as Christ spoke about becoming a Democrat, there's been a lot of animosity towards the former governor because of his support for the Defense of Marriage Act here in Florida back in 2008, and he actually stood by that decision to support the constitutional amendment when he was running for U.S. Senate. So now he says that he is against that. He said it was a mistake. But back then, he referred to it as late as 2010 as a sacred institution, marriage being between a man and a woman. And so gay Democrats, who he will certainly need to have in his corner, are very hesitant to support Christ in any future bids.
You're listening to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. That's Steve Rothaus with the Miami Herald. Also with us, Tim Padgett from Time Magazine and Ashley Lopez from WLRN Miami Herald News. And we'll get to one other thing before we turn our attention to education issues in our next segment. Elections on a fact-finding mission to sort out the state's voting woes last month. Florida Secretary of State Ken Detzner visited Broward and Palm Beach County's elections offices this week. All of South Florida struggled with long early voting lines. Here's Palm Beach County Supervisor of Elections Susan Booker. She says the state law where the county can set up, where the county can set up early voting sites, you can only use city halls, libraries, and elections offices that have been open for more than a year.
It's pretty apparent that, you know, when you're relegated to a small meeting room at a library, there's only so much equipment you can put in there. And in many instances, the power will not allow us to add additional printers, and it's constrained as to how many voters can come through.
Booker says she and Detzner also discussed the record-long ballot.
And he seemed to have heard that apparently at every location, that the 11 constitutional amendments and the lack of the restriction on the number of words for the amendments created a very long ballot, and it took them an extremely long time to be able to vote the amendments.
And, of course, the Secretary of State also dropping by Miami-Dade County on Monday. He'll take his findings and recommendations to the governor and state lawmakers. Ashley, you've done a lot of reporting on this story. What's the latest here? And is this the beginning of change?
I mean, we'll see. So far, I've been hearing Ken Detzner also blame the supervisors a lot. That they didn't map out those precincts correctly. You know, some were more, had more people than others. That's why, you know, let's say Brickell had really long lines, but some places in Westchester didn't, you know. You know, they're going to have to decide whether or not that law was really to blame for a lot of this. And they're going to have, and, you know, Democrats are the only ones introducing bills to fix anything. So they're going to have to decide whether or not they are as concerned as they say they are and are willing to change parts of it. It could be a combination. It could be, you know, the supervisors didn't do their jobs correctly and the law didn't work. So it's a matter of let's see what they decide to stick with.
The Miami Herald's Mark Caputo this week wrote about the nearly 2,500 Miami-Dade County voters who had their absentee ballots rejected this election. One of them, as we famously noted, I think last week, was Christian Slater, the actor, which we didn't know lived in Miami, or do we know? Now we know. Anyway, but this is, again, 2,500 absentee ballots rejected when more people are voting by absentee, and it didn't come down to anything, but it could have.
Yeah, I mean, well, the thing is, because early voting was cut, you know, the days were cut, there were a lot of campaigns, especially by third-party groups, to, you know, have these voters who were going to vote early to vote absentee. But they didn't do the same sort of campaigning to push them to, you know, update their signature and stuff like that. So a lot of people were blindsided. And it's a lot of steps to make sure that your vote is heard. And a lot of people don't really have time for that, I think.
Ashley Lopez, and you can read her stuff she writes, and at least for the next few days, and whatever's left on the archives. And she's going to WGC Radio in Fort Myers to help them out. Ashley has done some great work for us. Again, you can read it at WLRN.org. And also with us was Tim Padgett from Time Magazine and Steve Rothaus from the Miami Herald. When we come back, we're going to talk education, and that's going to be with our State Impact Florida reporter Sarah Gonzalez, and we'll talk about the new education commissioner and take your feedback as well through the PIN Public Insight Network. Stay with us. We're back in just a moment.
Walking in a winter wonderland.
And we welcome you back to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Little piece of the Christmas spirit. Hope you're all having a good holiday. Happy Hanukkah, if you're celebrating that. And your questions, by the way, are welcome for the panel. You can email us with your first name and location to the Florida Roundup at gmail.com. You can call us at 800-743-WLRN. You can also tweet us at @WLRN. I'm at Phil Latzman. So you say, why are we playing Tony Bennett? Well, because Florida Education is singing a new tune this week. It has a new education commissioner of the state. His name happens to be Tony Bennett, but has his choice struck a bad note with some educators. So that's bad. Florida Governor Rick Scott approves of the choice. He spoke at a dinner this week for the state's private school tax credit scholarship program. He says Bennett shares the education priorities of Florida leaders.
Tony understands the value of choice. Tony understands the value of measurement. Tony understands the value of accountability. He wants to do the right thing for charter schools, traditional public schools, for private schools, make sure we expand choice all across the state.
Bennett has been Indiana's top school officer since 2008, but he lost his reelection bid this year. The Florida State Board of Education unanimously chose Bennett to replace former Education Commissioner Gerard Robinson, who left the job in July. And joining us now for more on education issues in the state of Florida is our hardworking State Impact Florida reporter, Sarah Gonzalez. Sarah, welcome. Good to have you back on.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
So who is this Tony Bennett?
Well, he's a big believer in Florida education policies. He pushed test score-based teacher evaluations in Indiana. He ended teacher tenure. And like Florida, he got Indiana to hold back third graders who weren't reading at grade level. And Bennett said that he wants Florida to remain a national leader in education initiatives.
I think we have a great opportunity to capture Florida's moment, to continue to get the results you've gotten, and to continue to propel Florida to be the example for the rest of the country. So look forward to that challenge, look forward to working with you, and look forward to the great things ahead.
And former Florida Governor Jeb Bush is pals with Tony Bennett. He was really pushing for Bennett to get reelected in Indiana. And we at State Impact Florida spoke to Jeb Bush after Tony Bennett lost his reelection.
Do you consider it a setback to your education agenda?
Well, I mean, it's not my education agenda. It's the education agenda of the Indiana governor, the Indiana state school officer, the Indiana legislature, the Indiana business community that Tony Bennett didn't get elected.
And some folks, like this parent-driven advocacy group called Fund Education Now, they're upset that Bennett is now in Florida. They say more than a million people in Indiana voted not to reelect him, so you know, why is he here now? Bennett was making less than $80,000 a year in Indiana, and the Florida job pays $275,000.
Wow, that's quite a difference. And you're talking about an elected position in Indiana and an appointed position here in Florida. That's quite the raise, Sarah. And the one big deal he's going to have to deal with is the issue of remedial education in the state. You've done a lot of reporting on this during our segments on WLRN. High school graduates who are not prepared for college in 2001, more than half of the students coming out of high school failed at least one subject on Florida College System's placement test, 2011 rather. That meant they only had to pay tuition to take remedial courses in college. Sarah, what are one of these remedial courses like?
Well, I sat in on remedial math classes, remedial reading and writing classes, and was really shocked, actually, at how elementary some of the material was. Listen to this remedial reading class at Miami-Dade College.
R-E-E-K, reek. If you say, oh, that reeks. It smells, okay? But is it positive? Would you say, oh, yeah, I love her perfume. It reeks. Would you say that?
So, again, that's a college professor teaching college students about, you know, the denotations and connotations of words like reek. I went to a remedial writing class and learned that the goal of the class, of the semester-long college class, is for students to write one paragraph, a single paragraph using the right grammar and using all the right transitions. And professor said that it was really difficult for some of their students. In remedial math, the biggest problem was that students who were coming straight from a Florida high school, you know, not students who took a couple years off and then went back to college, students who came straight from a Florida high school who couldn't add or subtract without using calculators.
Now, how did that happen? Now, how does it happen that these kids are so unprepared for college in Florida in particular?
Well, there are a couple of problems. The first problem that I discovered during my reporting is, you know, I was asking state education officials and college officials, you know, what's going on? And the answer was, well, just because you got a high school diploma doesn't mean that you're, you know, necessarily ready for college. And then, you know, I kind of took a step back and I said, so what is the point then? What is the point of high school? And the answer was, well, we're kind of only now starting to make it so that a high school diploma does mean you're ready for college. Part of the problem was that, the two had never aligned their curriculum. So, for example, students up until next year, starting next year, students have been allowed to graduate from a Florida high school without taking a math class higher than Algebra 1, which in California, when I was in high school, Algebra 1 was a class that you had to take as a freshman in high school. But in Florida, for so long, that's all you needed to graduate. You know, so that's part of the problem. So it's now increased its graduation requirements, you know, in math, in science, and they're hoping, you know, that'll solve part of the problem. Another thing is that the Florida Department of Education and former Florida Governor Jeb Bush have said that the FCAT, Florida's high school exit exam, was never meant to test college readiness. They say, you know, it only tests 10th grade level math skills. It's only given to 10th grade students. But they're only now admitting this because the FCAT is making its way out. It's going to be replaced with a new standardized test in 2014-15, which is called PARC.
Common Core, right?
Yes. It's called the PARC test, P-A-R-C-C, but it's under the new Common Core standards, which, you know, 45 states and the District of Columbia are all going to be using.
We should mention, by the way, that you and McNelly Torres from the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting, we should mention that they helped the UN State Impact Florida and Florida Center for Investigative Reporting combined on this series about remedial education in Florida. And there's going to be an online chat with Sarah and McNelly Torres. That is Wednesday at 4 p.m. Next Wednesday at 4 p.m. You can tweet at call sign NPR Ed Chat. Sarah, really good reporting here. Thanks very much. We look forward to every Monday hearing those State Impact Florida pieces. And for more information, how do they get to you?
Follow me on Twitter, Gonzalez Sarah A, or go to State Impact Florida website.
All right. And just search on Google. Probably the best way to do that is to State Impact Florida. Thank you, Sarah.
Thanks, Phil.
All right. Now, Tim Padgett, you are a Hoosier,
yes.
Born and bred.
And proud of it.
And you've made some calls inquiring about Tony Bennett. What did you hear?
Well, my contacts who are plugged into education up in Indiana have offered the opinion that he was defeated, perhaps not so much because of his ideas and his policies, which is, you know, we've pointed out here, dovetail very well with the policies that have been in place as a result of Jeb Bush's administration. What probably got him defeated more than anything else, they say, is that he's very intolerant of dissent. He brings a very much of a my way or the highway approach, very gruff. And that's one of the reasons that a very obscure Democrat in Indiana was able to defeat him. And if he had that kind of a headbutting experience with the teachers union, he particularly alienated the teacher base in Indiana. That was one of his big problems. And if he had problems with that union there, imagine the kind of collision then that we're that's in store for us between him and the Florida Education Association here.
Yeah, they've already said, I don't know if we mentioned this, he's a champion, Florida Education Association says, he's a champion of testing mania, unchecked expansion of charter schools and voucher programs, and has proven to advance the Jeb Bush education agenda that has drawn fire from teachers, parents, and experts in the field. Anyway, so that's the capper on that. We did ask through the Public Insight Network, you this week, the question about remedial education in Florida, returning to that conversation. In fact, I think I said goodbye to Sarah, and I didn't mean to. So I hope she's still there, because you are, and I'm just a dummy. So Sarah is still with us. We'll say goodbye to her again. But we do have some folks on the line that are going to ask some questions when it comes to this. And we asked through the Public Insight Network how we got here, how we can fix it, and what should be the purpose anyway of high school in Florida. And we have some folks that are on the line. Who are we going to start with? Our Broward College professor. That's who we're going to start with. Who better to? Barbara, welcome to the Florida Roundup. Good to have you.
Thank you. Good morning. Afternoon.
Good afternoon. Actually, it's Saturday morning. We also replay the show, so you're right there. So tell us your perspective on what you just heard, the conversation about remedial education. You seem to be on the front lines.
Interestingly enough, my final exam, one of the questions was, I teach composition, one of the exam questions was, why do so many high school students enter college ill-prepared for college-level work? And I've just been grading these essays just the last 2 days, and from the students' perspective, it was a very interesting mix of answers. Most of them blamed the FCAT. Interestingly enough, they said all their high school did was focus on FCAT. Right, and not on actual learning. They also told me everything they ever needed to know was learned in middle school, and high school was a holding ground. And the third most cited reason was that the teachers really just let them slide. They were interested in them graduating, getting high FCAT scores, and leaving. And given that teacher salaries in Florida rank 47th in the nation, I don't know why our legislature hasn't equated that factor.
Ashley, you're a recent product. I would say you're younger than the rest of the panel here, so you know the high school situation better than we do, at least in recent times. You're a product of the system here. What do you think? Too much focused on the FCAT when you went to school?
I definitely felt that way. About the time I got to 10th grade, that finally stopped, and I was able to do like advanced placement college work. And those classes really prepared me for college, and I didn't feel so left behind. But I mean, how many students take AP classes? I know I've heard from, you know, my other friends who weren't in those classes that they were basically left in a classroom to themselves after FCAT. It was really relaxing, I guess. I mean, they had a great time, but they were not prepared for Miami-Dade. And so a lot of them, I can think on the top of my head, maybe five people who have been taking remedial classes for 2 years at Miami-Dade and paying for it out of pocket for, you know, what is basically 13th grade.
Yeah, I'm a parent of a middle schooler and a high schooler, and all I hear from them is FCAT, or the past FCAT. I think we sort of have to change the way we look at FCAT exams, and obviously we're changing to this new Common Core standard. But Sarah, let me go ahead, because you spoke to Jeb Bush about this too, and he was a big champion of the FCATs. Yeah. Barbara, thanks for your call, by the way.
Thank you.
Yeah, was it Barbara?
Yes.
Barbara, thanks. Yeah, you know, she sparked something in me. One of the students that I interviewed, Shakira Lockett, she had an interesting experience. She said she was always really bad at math in high school. She always got really low grades, but she always got really good grades in English classes. Reading and writing was like her subject. And then she took the FCAT. And she failed the English portion of the FCAT, but passed the FCAT math. So she was really confused, you know, like my whole life in school, I've been really bad at math, and yet I passed the FCAT first and not, you know, English and reading. And then when she got to college, she failed the math placement, but didn't do so bad on the reading and writing placement college test. So it just kept flipping on her. And, you know, she to this day, she doesn't really know which area she's actually the best at.
All right, let's take another call. In fact, Jessica from Kendall is also an intern for us at WL and Miami Herald News and has a unique story. She was actually a student at Miami-Dade College and had to take remedial math. Jessica, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So how did you do in high school? And I know you were a pretty good student, right?
Well, from middle school through high school, I was always an honors student. Yes.
And how did you take the college placement test, and how did you do on it?
Well, the way that I always got through honors classes in high school was that I actually I didn't do well on the tests themselves. I would just turn in all the assignments and do well on all the take home works, and then that actually leveled up my grade. And then so when I went to take the SAT, it was a test on its own, and I didn't do well on it. And then that led me to the college placement test at Miami-Dade College, where that put me to take 5 math classes before I could actually attain my AA degree.
And how was your remedial math class? You have an experience there.
Well, it was interesting because I had one teacher who, it was a 7 o'clock in the morning class, and he would just yell at us, you know, one remedial math teacher, he would just yell at us, and it actually, more than half of the class just dropped it, and I decided to stick it through, and I unfortunately ended the class with a D. I took the exact same course the next semester with a teacher who was very clear on assignments, very clear on the problems, and I actually got an A in that class, the same exact class. So I think it flip-flops as well with the teachers, with the professors there, when the understanding of what remedial students need, pretty much.
So was it all worth it? And you sound like you turned out pretty well.
Well, it was worth it in the sense that, I mean, 5 math classes later, I do enjoy certain levels of math. I did enjoy statistics at the end. But yeah, no, it's great. I'm at FIU now, but I'm mostly just love journalism. So.
Well, thanks for interning with us, and thanks for the thoughts as well.
No, thank you very much for having me.
I'll take one more on this. Alex, also a member of the Public Insight Network, has some reflections for us. Alex, welcome to the Florida Roundup.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for having me. Well, yeah, I do have some interesting thoughts on this. I mean, I lived in Miami for the majority of my life. I went to Johnny Ferguson Senior. From there, I went to MDC College. From there, I then also transferred to FIU, where I'm now majoring in political science and philosophy of law. A lot of work that I'm doing now, interesting work. I love what I do. I love what I'm studying. But I guess transitioning back to my times at MDC, I worked for the campus. I enjoyed the campus. I enjoyed, you know, having the relationships that I developed with the teachers there. It was great and all, but I did not feel prepared for the challenges that were ahead of me, the challenges I would go through, the classes I would end up taking. I took plenty of remedial classes, failed some of them, had to retake them, and it was very frustrating for me. Now, I would also want to point out that in my high school career, I admit I was not the best student. I also didn't feel challenged enough. Not that I'm using the FCAT as a scapegoat, but I do remember more than anything else, it was a lot of FCAT material that we had to study. I wasn't challenged in critical thinking. I don't remember going on a lot of field trips. Don't really remember, I guess, being interested in school. I didn't like school. Mm-hmm. I actually didn't grow to like school until about my second year in MDC, when I finally realized, you know what, I think I want to involve myself in.
Did you take any AP courses?
Actually, no, I didn't.
Did,
I couldn't make the cut. I couldn't keep up with the study work, and it was difficult for me. But the majority of the work I did do was based on FCAT, and it was FCAT this and FCAT that, and we had FCAT T-shirts, and it was all these FCAT sponsorships, and then the grading of the schools, are we an A, B, or C school, and the grade of the school would determine so much.
Right.
And so the students had a lot of pressure. The teachers had a lot of pressure. Administration had a lot of pressure. And a lot of this, at the end, revolved around the FCAT. And I would admit, it did affect me. It did affect me because I would later transition to my college years and find myself, wow, I feel kind of dumb. I feel cheated.
Alex, thanks very much for the thoughts there. And actually, I have to we'll cap off with Steve because you grew up down here before FCATs. We should say
right, well,
but I didn't grow up here. But I took standardized testing just like you did. How has it always been this way?
Well, it seems to me that at least from the time that I arrived here, which was in 1974, and I was in high school, and I had moved here from New York, that education at least in the public school level, always got the short shrift. I went to North Miami Beach Senior High School, which was a new school at the time. It had only been open about 2 years. And by the time I arrived 2 years later, it was already so overcrowded that we were on three sessions. So there was one 7 a.m. to noon session. Then there was another session from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. And then the third session from noon to 5 p.m. And everything was rushed. We didn't have desks. We didn't have the tools then that we needed. But, you know, it was pre-FCAT. So basically, I think what went well back then was the fact that we could choose classes that interested us. And so it was during an era in which there were these open classrooms. And so as a result, you didn't feel that you were being forced to do something. You could engage on a different level. But, of course, that didn't work out because they had other problems as a result.
Sarah, what we're finding is that education in Florida is an imperfect science, and it probably will never – this is not going to be the education state. Are we – I mean, I hate to sound pessimistic, but –
No. I mean, you know, we are kind of ground zero for education initiatives, reforms across the country. You know, one of the things that some critics are saying is, you know, now we're moving away from the FCAT. We're transitioning into PARC under Common Core. The problem is it's never been tested. So we don't really know if it'll do what the test developers think it'll do.
Sarah, can I? This is Steve.
I gotta get to a break, Steve. But if you want to ask one little brief question, maybe she can answer it briefly.
I just want to know, where does Florida rank nationally in terms of education, in terms of scores, and in terms of funding?
I think it depends on what you're looking at. I mean, a new report just came out that said Florida's fourth graders read at the same level as the best in the world. So we were on par with Russia and Hong Kong and Finland. And that's great news.
Yeah, I saw that report. That's something very interesting to cap off with. We'll leave it there. Sarah Gonzalez, you can read her work again at State Impact Florida. Just search for it on Google. Great stuff, Sarah. Thanks very much.
Okay, thanks, Phil.
And thanks to all of our members of the Public Insight Network for that discussion, great extended discussion on education. We're going to get back to some other stuff, talk about climate change, the Miami Herald building not being preserved, and perhaps even a discussion about Venezuela and Hugo Chavez's cancer relapse. We'll discuss those things as we come back. The Florida Roundup continues. And we welcome you back to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. To reintroduce ourselves, I'm Phil Latzman, along with Tim Padgett from Time Magazine, based here in South Florida. Also is with us Steve Rothaus with the Miami Herald. You can find his work at miamiherald.com/gays. He covers LGBT issues for the paper and a whole lot of other stuff. And Ashley Lopez from our WLRN Miami Herald News outfit is with us as well. Back to another big issue we've discussed on this program over the past few weeks and months, even years, really. I've been covering this story about climate change and sea level rise here in South Florida, and now we're all beginning to notice it. Sand dunes and steel sheets will be used as temporary fixes to shore up a portion of Fort Lauderdale Beach and State Road A1A that have been overrun by the beach. The $4.5 million plan was announced at a public meeting this week, and it will be a band-aid until a permanent fix is found. Broward's Mayor Kristen Jacobs says it's the best they can do to deal with the problem in the short term.
Obviously, we're going to have to build the road up higher, which means a seawall that's higher, in order to hold dunes. We're going to have dunes as a part of the future. How quickly all that can get done to save this season, that's another story. I think there's a lot of engineers scratching their head about what to do and what to do fast.
Dr. Jennifer Hirado is Director of Natural Resources Planning and Management for Broward County.
It does require extensive coordination with the state, Florida Department of Environmental Protection, Florida Department of Transportation, the city of Fort Lauderdale, and we're really scrambling to try and find the resources needed in order to shore up the foundation of the beach in order to begin thinking about improvements to the roadway.
The plan calls for beach widening of 20 to 40 feet in sections of Fort Lauderdale Beach and expected to be completed by late March. And this is going to be an issue that everybody is going to deal with. Tim Padgett, one of those incremental things we talk about, but now we see it.
And it all boils down to one thing, as far as I'm concerned. This state and this country has got to start curtailing coastal development. Time magazine hit on this right after Sandy on our cover. We've seen a 52%, or I'm sorry, more than half of the country's population now lives in coastal counties. That's an astonishing increase. It's a 45% increase over the past few decades. And it's expected to see another 10% increase between now and 2020. That's unsustainable. We can't keep developing on the coasts, particularly in Florida, and not expect to see a disastrous impact.
Steve, you've lived here for a long time. Is it something that we've known about? And I speak to people all the time, say, I've known this 40 years ago. But, I mean, did you see this coming so quickly?
Well, I mean, we've been re-nourishing the beach for years and years. I mean, and every time a storm comes through, the work that was done disappears. But I think we also have an issue here where, you know, okay, we can't develop on the coast, but then where do we develop in South Florida? You go west, and then you hit another issue, and you're out in the Everglades.
So we're squeezed. Perhaps. No place to go.
True, but again, what's required is smart growth management. And one of the problems in Florida is that you've got an administration right now in Tallahassee that has been doing everything it can to dismantle the growth management apparatus we have, particularly agencies like the Department of Community Affairs, et cetera, that's been watching things, overseeing things like the Everglades boundary. Without that kind of apparatus, it's going to be very hard to do responsible coastal development.
And Ashley, the state really hasn't had much to say about all of this, that we've heard at least.
I mean, what are they going to say? I mean, if they take this seriously, they're going to have to flood, you know, millions of dollars into, you know, retrofitting, you know, drainage throughout the entire state. And, you know, they're going to have to make very serious changes to the way we, you know, develop and the way we, you know, get energy. I mean, it's going to have to come to something pretty serious before it's taken pretty seriously.
By the way, this and other topics to be discussed more online as we are doing our online chat with our Danny Rivera, who is our online editor. And you can get involved with that by tweeting us at WLRN. The issue will live on as we continue the program throughout and really 24 hours a day, 7 days a week if you follow us on Twitter at WLRN. Speaking of waterfront property, up for debate this week in front of the Miami Historic Preservation Board was the future of the Miami Herald Building.
We ask you to designate as historic the Miami Herald Building, a building that for half a century has been Miami's flagship landmark.
All too often, preservation is used as a zoning tool to prevent development, rather than basing designation on the actual historical and architectural significance of the building.
I've never heard anyone ever say, what a beautiful building.
I do not agree that the Herald Building should be designated as a historic structure.
So, in the end, by a vote of 5-3, the board denied a request to declare that building, which Steve and Ashley and I actually work out of, an historic site. The city's preservation officer had argued that the building built in 1962 met the criteria for the designation. The majority of the board members disagreed. Any surprise there, Steve? Of course, the building sold to Genting Group, the gambling. We've talked about that on the show as well.
Well, I'm really not surprised. And I think that, you know, throughout this process that it was mentioned that the Miami Herald Building was essentially a duplicate. It was the second building built in the same manner as the Chicago Sun-Times building. That was built in 1957, about 5 years before the Miami Herald Building. But what was not really said, at least not loudly, was the fact that in 2004, that original building, the building that was the model for the Miami Herald Building, it was demolished back in 2004 to make way for a Donald Trump building.
Donald Trump, right.
Interesting. But this is obviously the Genting Group, and they didn't want the designation to interfere with their plans to demolish the building for a future resort that may or may not include casino gambling. And last week, I think we mentioned that the Genting has given up their efforts, at least right now, to put this on the ballot in 2014. But they say they're going to build the resort anyway. What do you think that spot's going to look like in a few years?
Well, they're going to build something, and I think that one of the main issues all along has been the fact that the Herald Building has blocked the view of the bay. So I think that whatever Genting decides to do with the property, they're going to have to, at the very least, provide some access to the waterfront.
And one other thing that we should mention about at least the Miami area is that the Miami Beach Convention Center is moving forward on a plan for redevelopment. Miami Beach voted to move forward with a vote of 6-1 to pursue a long-delayed project to renovate and expand the convention center, build an 800-room hotel, and convert the surrounding land into a potentially 6 million square foot complex. How important are places like convention centers? They kind of get overlooked. We talk about Super Bowls and boat shows, but convention centers have to be there in order for these things to happen, right?
Well, they're more important than casinos, I can tell you that, especially in Florida and especially in South Florida, where I think it's a little distressing that for such a, you know, an important spot like that in Florida, what we're doing to fill it is with more low-wage, low-tech industry, which is the last thing I think South Florida needs.
As long as we're on Miami Beach, Steve, you've done a lot of coverage of the Miami Beach police officers who beat up a couple of gay men on the beach very horribly a few years ago. They have their jobs back now.
One of the police officers. Okay. The other one has not yet gone to an arbitrator to get his job back. But this last week, Officer Hazi, who was one of the two officers involved about 2.5 years ago in the beating of two gay men, was reinstated with full pay.
By the way, nobody covers LGBT issues better in this area, or for that matter, any area, than Steve. And you can get him at miamiherald.com/gay. And he's also reachable at Steve Rothaus on Twitter, Rothaus. Tim Padgett, too, I know for you. But I wanted to cap off talking with you about the relapse for Hugo Chavez. A lot of Venezuelan nationals here in South Florida.
Exactly.
In many places. So what's the latest there? And can he survive? Can the government survive there?
Well, the big question is, will he be back in Venezuela in time for his January 10th inauguration? If not, they're going to have to declare him ineligible to be sworn in, and they'll have to hold a special presidential election then in 30 days' time. And that's got the country.
He's in Cuba.
He's in Cuba right now. He just had a new round of cancer surgery. His recovery could take longer than between now and January 10th. And a lot of people feel that it's a serious enough case that he may not even survive between now and then.
But he did appoint a vice president. So.
Well, the problem is, though, the vice president does not automatically become. He's quite an authoritarian figure, so he's done everything in the Constitution to make sure his vice presidents have a very weak profile. So that's why if he's not able to continue his to fulfill his next term, they have to hold this special presidential election within 30 days, and that could cause quite a bit of disarray in a country that could use it the least.
A preview of what might happen in 2013. And Ashley, we'll officially say goodbye to you. We've really enjoyed working with you. You've been a panelist on this show. You've shown us so much in the first just a few months that you've been with us at WLRN. Tell us about your future endeavors.
Yeah, I'll be a full-time reporter and fill-in host over at WGCU, which is based in Fort Myers, starting January 7th.
Well, we've enjoyed your work. And
thank you.
You can read what's on there at WLRN.org. Steve, you want to have the last word? Anything you're following that people want to read in your stories?
Actually, I'm going on vacation this
week.
Oh,
good for you. I guess a lot of people are going.
I'll second that. Yes, too.
Well, that'll be a good way to sort of wrap things up here. That'll do it for the Florida Roundup this Friday, December the 14th. Are we actually leaving a little bit early, but why not? Friday, December 14th, 2012. Ashley, again, good luck to you. If you missed any of the show, you can listen to it again on these airwaves tomorrow morning at 6 a.m., or you may be listening to it right about at 7 a.m. on Saturday mornings. We also do post it on our website at WLRN.org. The Florida Roundup is produced by Alicia Zuckerman. Elaine Chen, our associate producer. Thank you very much, Elaine, for everything. Our executive producer for WLRN is Peter J. Meritz. For WLRN Miami Herald News, it's Dan Gretsch. Our technical supervisor is Paul Leary. Thank you, Paul. Flawless as usual. South Florida Arts Beat is next. If it's Friday afternoon, if it's Saturday morning, you'll have only a game. Until next week at this time, I'm Phil Latzman. Thank you, panelists, and stay informed, South Florida.
You are listening to 91.